Welcome to the Tournament Poker Edge podcast, brought to you by TournamentPokerEdge.com, the only podcast dedicated exclusively to poker tournament strategy. Now here's your host, Clayton Fletcher.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Tournament Poker Edge podcast. I am your, I can't believe I'm about to say it, host, Clayton Fletcher. I'm so excited to be the new host of the TPE podcast. For those who were expecting to hear a more familiar voice, don't worry. In just a few seconds, I'm going to bring on two of the TPE regulars and pros that you guys know, and so you can settle into a more comfortable zone. In the meantime, I hope that you will get used to hearing my voice, because I intend to bring you content each and every week on this channel, and I hope that you guys will like what we do. You can expect talk about what's going on in the tournament world, talk about what's happening with the major tournament series, such as the World Poker Tour, the WSOP, W Coupe, and on and on and on. Also, of course, we're never going to get rid of the ever popular strategy segment. And this week, we're going to have two really crucial hands from the late stages of this year's World Series of Poker as seen on ESPN. I actually intend to do that for the next several weeks, watch the coverage, and then talk about it on the podcast so you guys can get a little bit of analysis on what you're watching on the weekends. So without further ado, let's kick it off and go right to my conversation with Mark Alioto and Andrew Brokus here on the TPE podcast.
So let's bring on our guests. I am very excited. For my first time hosting this podcast, I thought of three or four guys that would like to have do it with me, and none of them were available. So instead, we have my dear friend, Twin Poker Ed Coach Jordanaire, Twitter. He's way funnier than I'll ever be on Twitter, and he's also quite an accomplished tournament player himself. Andrew Brokus is in the building, guys. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. Congratulations on your new post here.
Yeah, thanks. This is pretty cool. Also, I know the listeners are huge fans of this guy. He's an amazing poker player, really funny dude as well, and someone that we're going to have some fun with today. Please welcome Tournament Poker Edge Pro Mark Alioto. Hey, Mark.
How you doing? I will say Andrew does have better Twitter than me, so he can have that accolade. But yeah, happy to be here, and happy you're doing this, because we need more than three podcasts a year, so this is good.
Yeah. The over-under was three before I decided to... basically, I called Derek Henbush, also known as Killing Bird, up and begged him for a job, and he gave me one, so that was pretty cool. So
you've been able to transfer some skills from comedy into your poker podcasting career?
Well, we'll leave that up to the fans to decide whether I'm transferring anything at all.
Well, I just meant begging for jobs.
Oh, yeah, begging for jobs, right, perfect. Yeah, see, sometimes he's so funny, I don't even get him. So here we go, guys. I'm talking about the stuff that's going on in the poker world right now. I know this is a tournament show, but I feel like this new story with Chad and Kate has been getting so much attention, and I kind of wanted to get two guys I really respect to give their opinions on it. So, for anyone that might not know, there was an issue with Chad Powers and Kate Hall where he was her backer, and somewhere along the line she decided that she doesn't want to be a poker player anymore. And they basically had a whole arbitration system where she had someone, she has a law background, so full disclosure there. She had someone represent her side, and he had someone represent his side, and they made the whole argument very public, so I think it's pretty safe for us to be talking about it here. But, Andrew, where did you kind of land on the whole controversy, and what are your thoughts?
I hate to be a party pooper. I think I'm gonna no comment this one on the specifics. I mean, my main takeaway from this is I don't see a lot of reason why this shouldn't have been in writing. I can imagine some reasons why it wouldn't be, and Nate Mavis suggested some, but I mean, I kind of think you're asking for this sort of situation if you don't put things in writing. I think without anything in writing, it's very hard to arbitrate, which is why I'm not interested in getting too personally mired in the details.
No, I think your answer is fine. I mean, that's a pretty good comment for a no comment, but I know what you mean. Like, you didn't want to say, like, whose side you're on, and I'm not asking either of you to pick sides unless you happen to have one. But yeah, I think it's really interesting to talk about backing and staking. And I know that most poker players at this point, especially like for big events such as the World Series of Poker and other, you know, big tournament series, they sell shares. So Mark, let me go to you. Like, what are your thoughts on being a backer, having backers, and, you know, kind of as it relates to this whole controversy?
Well, are you clear on the details? Because I read a little bit into it, but then I kind of just, I was like, you know what? I have way too many things going on in my life to pay attention to this, because I do back players. And I believe she was getting staked in cash, and now she's quitting poker. I mean, it's so, do you have the details in front of you, or can you maybe fill me in a little bit more? Because I will have an opinion.
You're never short on opinions. But, yeah, the bottom line is he was staking her for cash games. And as Andrew mentioned, they did not have anything in writing.
Which I think is a massive mistake. I agree with Andrew there. That's just, yeah, you're asking for this, like you said.
Yeah, obviously that was a mistake that, as there could be reasons why, but, you know, any reason at all, you got to have something, at least in email writing, some kind of written word so that it's not just my word against his. But, you know, short of that, let's just say that he was giving her money to play cash games with the understanding that be playing in cash games for the foreseeable future. But I always like to joke that there's no such thing as the foreseeable future. And I think this case really highlights that. Maybe since, Mark, you're not as familiar with the exact details, we don't want to have a gossip show off the bat of my first episode. But just in general, you say you back players. What would you do if one of your players that was in makeup decided not to be a poker player anymore? Would you feel that you were entitled to some kind of refund? Or what would your thoughts be on just that in general, just leaving Kate and Chad out of it?
Yeah, no, I don't think I would be entitled to a refund. I wouldn't be happy about the situation. I usually stake based on total games played. I've had people leave in makeup, and some people have sent money. Some have just left, and, you know, that's just a hit to the ROI. It's not great. The tricky part is if they come back and play. My opinion there is that I think they have to come back to the person who's staking them first, or at least tell them and then have their other backer buy them out. So I've been in a situation with that. But yeah, I wouldn't feel entitled to money from them if they just decided to quit. I would kind of just be like, wow, that sucks. They don't want to play anymore. I don't want to stake someone that doesn't want to play. So yeah, it's a tricky spot. But again, if it was in writing, it would be much easier to pick it apart and be like, well, maybe this, maybe that. I mean, I read a little bit of on Twitter, and I was just, yeah, like I said, I just wasn't really interested in it, because that's something you don't want to get involved in. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't expect money.
Yeah, I
mean,
I agree with you. And I think I would probably usually want to set up my backing arrangements with a time period. You know, I'm going to give you X amount of dollars for the next 6 months, and then, you know, maybe do it like that. I mean, I know staking has changed a lot over the years. In the early days of staking, your backer would kind of pay for everything, including your flights, your housing, and everything. And there really never used to be any such thing as makeup. I actually have a book in my library of poker books. It's called Professional Poker, and there's an entire, like, 30-page chapter on staking. And it basically makes the case that makeup is a bad thing, and that people who stake other people should realize that what it does is sets up a situation where the horse ends up wanting to find a new backer after they get a certain amount, you know, buried. They just say, well, why don't I just start fresh with a new backer? Of course, that's from another time, before Twitter and before the whole world knew everybody else's business, as we do today. So
I agree. I think makeup is horrible, because you get people in hundreds, thousands of dollars of makeup sometimes. I mean, I'm not even close to that big, but like thousands of makeup, and they start playing horrifically. There's new deals out there that my buddies are a part of where there's no makeup at all. They just get a really small piece. And I think for the mental aspect, that makes them perform at a higher level more often. I think it's genius to get rid of makeup. So, yeah, I'm with that. Yeah, Andrew, how do you feel about that, out of curiosity? Like, I think makeup is necessary, but, like, I kind of think these new deals without makeup are pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, I have a very limited backing experience, and I've never, I mean, I've when I sell action, it's just a matter of, like, you know, selling shares for, you know, maybe a peckable Clayton. Clayton has been an investor. You know, I always set mine up without makeup when I'm selling. It's just, you know, a package for a particular series events, or sometimes even just one event. And I would say the majority of your staking of individuals that I've done has not entailed makeup. And I think there's kind of an implicit assumption behind, you know, I've seen, like, Jungle Man posted something on 2+2 recently, just kind of about the importance of that you just sort of have an ethical obligation, I guess, to ensure that a plucky spot for a person who, like, takes a chance on you. And I think there's a lot to say about that, but I think the key about getting rid of makeup, and the thing that I like, is just the idea of looking at people's incentives rather than just expecting that they're going to behave, even your definition of honorably, because I think it's not even a matter of people necessarily, like, deliberately trying to scam somebody. I think sometimes people just have, and I think that may be the case here, people just have different ideas about what constitutes, you know, the right thing to do, or what their, like, ethical obligation is above and beyond just kind of doing the thing that makes the most sense for them given the terms of the deal. And I mean, my preference is just not to make deals like that, you know, not to make a deal that relies on someone just sort of voluntarily behaving in a certain way. Like, I would rather just have it be in writing, especially if it's a friend. You know, I think it's easy to friendship over a legitimate misunderstanding of a back situation. No one's trying to take advantage of someone else, but just two people have different interpretations, and if you didn't do a good job of trying to anticipate, there'll be some possible misunderstandings. I think both people can walk away from a situation feeling like they're right, but it could be a really big, messy dispute.
Well, certainly, and I think, you know, what I've seen in this particular situation that kind of birthed this conversation in the first place is that it seems to be the public opinion, since that's where they decided to have their argument, is in court of public opinion, seems to be kind of divided on gender lines for the most part, which I find kind of sad, you know, because it just seems like the guys are Tad and the girls in general are with Kate, and I just think that this is a little bit more nuanced than that. But you know what? Another point I wanted to make, Shakespeare said it best, neither a borrower nor a lender be. But I don't think Shakespeare was backing poker players either.
We don't know about Shakespeare, Clint.
Yeah, can't be sure either way. All right, cool. So, yeah, guys, thanks for jumping in with that. I like to kind of open up the show with, you know, whatever hot tops are. Now, Andrew, I want to talk to you about Twitter. Obviously, the funniest poker account on Twitter. If we had a competition,
probably
have to be Jamie.
Former TB, bro.
Yeah, Jamie's hilarious. Yeah, and I'm a comedian, and I sit here and read you guys on Twitter. I'm like, they are so funny in this format. You guys are really just killing it. I love reading what you and Jamie write. You're one of the key reasons I go to Twitter. Now, it seems to me like, in your case at least, that you do it kind of to entertain yourself at the table. Am I right about that? Do you think that's what's going on?
Yeah, that's a lot of it. You know, I just think live poker can be kind of slow. And you might say, like, just staring at your phone means you're not engaged with what's going on. I mean, I don't want to contend that, like, everything I'm doing on my phone all the time is, like, really ideally engaged with the game. But, you know, a lot of what I find funny and a lot of what I find gets a good reaction on Twitter is not really stuff I'm coming up with. It's stuff that I'm repeating, that I'm hearing at the table, that I think is just so much funny, oftentimes unintentionally funny stuff that people are doing at the poker table. So I actually do think of it in part as a way of staying at least somewhat engaged with the game, as opposed to just playing Words with Friends or something on my phone. Like, I think that I, if I'm kind of actively looking for good anecdotes that I can share on Twitter, I feel like that does actually feel a little more engaged.
Your play-by-play on dealers is hilarious. Like, now dealing from Missouri. Like, Chester, I mean, dude, I got, like, because I didn't go to the series this year because I was dealing with some family stuff. But, like, I live vicariously through your Twitter and Jamie's. Like, and your play-by-play on dealers, though, is, like, heaven. I wish you would do that every tournament. That's hilarious.
I kind of wish I did, too. The easy thing, it started when I was playing at Maryland Live. And there, the dealers work in tags that have information about themselves on it, so they, like, have to put an interest or something up or something. I guess they're, like, required to put that on their name tag. So it's an easy, which I'm sure, you know, the point is that it sparked this kind of conversation with players, but it makes it very easy to get information. I've been encouraged to try to do that sometimes when I'm actually playing, but I'm not a terribly socially active person, so it sort of feels like work to me sometimes to try to strike up those conversations. But I appreciate that encouragement. Thank you.
Yeah, you're such an antisocial millennial, Andrew Burgess. So what about you, Mark? Are you a Twitter guy, or do you like to tweet? Do you like to get in there?
I'm more of I like reading Twitter. So I'm on Twitter all the time, but I prefer to read. In Vegas, I tweet a lot when I do play live. I don't play much live, so I'm not going to tweet like 8 tabling on ACR and doing play-by-play like that. I will say, Andrew brought up some topics about a lot playing with an iPad and your iPhone. First, I was so against it. I was like, oh, you need to be focused, like paying attention to the game. But you're there so long that like, not listening to music, not like, I mean, I started watching poker on my iPad, and I honestly thought I was playing better because I wasn't bored. I mean, I go from 2 years ago, 20 table, like, blurting sit and go to playing one hand every, you know, 30, 35 minutes. You need something else. Like, it's okay to distract yourself a little bit. I'm still aware of what's going on and seeing hands at showdown, but I think it's kind of important to, like, yeah, like, maybe not play Words with Friends or Chinese or something, but I think it's okay to take your mind off the game when you're there sometimes 14 hours at a time. Online is a different story. Like, I feel like you really need to pay attention. Like, I play with the HUD, and I'm fully engaged. Like, I'm clicking a million buttons every second, so it's a bit different, but I get antsy live, and I don't want to just, like, punt my stack. I'd rather be distracted on something else if I feel it's going to help me play better.
And I think it's just unreasonable.
Yeah, if the options are be distracted or...
I was going to say, I think, yeah, like, you're not going to be able to stay focused for, you know, 12, or at least I can't. I think most people can't just give, you know, full focus 12 hours, especially when you're going to be doing it for, you know, weeks like you are WSOP or something. So I think trying to, you know, giving yourself permission to only be giving it 80% for certain portions of, you know, for the first few hours of a tournament or something like that. And, you know, day two, day three, I'm a lot more focused. But, you know, early day ones, I give myself some permission to, you know, take a mental rest at the tables, I guess, is a way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I definitely think that it's negative EV to not be paying attention to 100% of the activity at the table at all times. But I also think that I'm only human, and sometimes, you know, just reading about what's going on at Andrew's table on Twitter during the tournament can kind of, you know, just give me a little levity and help me kind of stay fresh, because I think if you concentrate too hard for too long, you end up doing more harm than good.
Yeah.
And, you know, without the performance-enhancing drugs like some of the guys use, such as Adderall, et cetera.
Well, if they tested for that, the main event would have, like, 30 runners.
Yeah, well,
it would be
one of them. I'm proud to say I've never used it, but I can't believe how often people ask me if I have one.
Oh, it's
at the poker
so
table. It's so common that just people are just openly asking me, hey, yeah, I'm out of Adderall. Do you have one? I'm
like,
never had it.
Or something.
Yeah, I'm like, I have a Tic Tac if you want.
Can I bum an Adderall?
yeah, they really do. It's kind of outrageous. So, Mark, I want to get into the World Series a little bit. You mentioned that you were unable to attend this summer. So what was it like for you being away from all the action? I know that you have so much passion for the game, and you know, obviously the listeners know that from previous podcasts that you really get into the World Series. Was it just really hard to be away?
Yeah, so I think I had played 7 years straight, like since basically joining TV and they had a home. I was like, all right, and I got into tournaments that year too. So it had been 7 years straight, and this year I wouldn't have been mentally there because, you know, I had some family problems at home that I need to take care of, and I'm happy I didn't stay home.
Sure.
It was brutal. Like, at first I thought about blocking all the poker players because, you know, you see guys on deep runs and, you know, you're reading all these hands, and I love the game, and, you know, I ended up falling in love with it because, like, it was okay to play, because, like, Poker Go and all the live broadcasts, I felt like I was there still, and I actually enjoyed the main event coverage more than I have in the previous 6 or 7 years. I loved the live feed, and I was glued to it, like, every day. The second it came on, I put it on the screen, and I was sitting there, like, I probably put on, like, 10, 15 pounds just sitting there watching poker, and I loved it, like, so yeah, tough at first, but then, you know, I just kind of like, you know what, whatever, I'm going to be there next year. I want to sweat people. So I actually bought a lot of pieces too, which I don't like buying live pieces. It's just a preference of mine. I prefer online. But yeah, this year I was like, all right, I got to take pieces with friends and some guys I know are good. Just, I need a little sweat because I am an action junkie, so.
It's nice to have action during the main event, of course, and just, you know, all the tournaments, and just, it's kind of poker heaven. For those who haven't been in Las Vegas in the summertime, I mean, I've gone for the past 11 years, and I always have so much fun out there. No more so than this summer, where most of you know I had a good amount of success. I finished 28th in the main event. Was pretty excellent. I could have done better, could have done a lot worse. But yeah, all in all, I have to say it was a great summer. But I want to talk a little bit more about the coverage, because we had Poker Go, which, I mean, for anyone who doesn't pay $10 a month to just watch more poker than you can ever imagine watching, I don't understand like how you can be a pro player and be that cheap. I think everyone should be on Poker Go. There's so much poker content, you could never watch it all. Literally, there's more on there than you could watch in your life. So, you know, go get it, watch all those hands. You can, you know, feel like you're part of the main event. I really enjoy the fact that they had a number of different fields this year. They had the Poker Go, which is really for the hardcore players. They also had a lot of events on Twitch. Did you get to check out any of the Twitch coverage? Andrew, did you get to see anything?
No, this is going to sound really douchey, but truthfully, I really don't enjoy watching poker. I don't do a lot of it.
But okay, that's something I hear a lot of poker players say, and I think that I can understand it. Like, if you'd rather be playing, you don't want to watch. But for me, I feel like I learned so much watching. Like, if I know that someone who's way better than I am is playing, and I can watch that person and each decision that he or she makes, that's huge for me. It's well worth it. I mean, yeah, I don't like to watch, like, old school 2003 WSOP where it's just a bunch of coin flips and you don't even know what the stack sizes are. But nowadays, it's gotten so sophisticated, you can actually, I think you can get a lot out of it. So, Mark, since you weren't able to be there and you were checking out a lot of other coverage, first of all, did you notice the difference between what they did on Twitch and what they did on PokerGo and what they did on ESPN, for that matter?
Yeah, I didn't have a preference. I definitely watched both of them. I'm curious about Andrew. If he wasn't at the series, like, you wouldn't want to watch Paul Volpe and Sean Dean heads up, like, three-handed for, like, 3 hours playing, like, 60, 70 digs deep. Like, I don't know. That's, like... Like, I was pretty excited for stuff like that. Like, I'm not going to lie. Even if I was in Vegas, I would still watch that. But maybe it's because you play so much that, I mean, like, it's like...
If I were to watch anything, it would be something like that. And I do... I'll watch Twitch streams sometimes. I'm blanking on his name. There's a real good German player was streaming some during WCOOP, and I watched some of that. But... Yeah, I don't find it entertaining. If I'm watching it, it's for, you know, educational value.
Yeah.
I rarely really find it, like, entertaining.
Especially, like, the WPT broadcast where they show, yeah, five hands, all ends. Like, it's completely worth it. But, like, watching hand for every hand, like, Volpe and Deeb three-handed was, I mean, I was like, damn, I have a lot of work to do. I need to study. I need to run some Sims and PO or something.
I will say, and, you know, this is a... Maybe there's, like, a confounding variable here, because doing anything with Carlos is great, but watching poker with Carlos is a little different. He, it's so anxious, his enjoyment of it.
It's my favorite thing. He's by far my favorite person to watch poker with. It's not even close. And he gets, like, super excited for it, too. Which, yeah, you're right. It's infectious. It's awesome.
Yeah, Carlos is universally everyone's favorite person to do anything with. So why would poker watching be any different? It's cool that you watch the you're talking about the 50K at the end of the series where it ended up with Sean Deeb and Paul Volpe heads up. I was honored to have been asked to do commentary for that event. It was actually the day after I busted out of the main event, along with David Tuckman on the Twitch stream, which, you know, those two guys going at it. It was ridiculous.
Dude, that's right. I completely blanked on that.
Yeah, I was really happy to have been asked to do that. I think one reason was because I was one of the few players that was still in town at that point. It was really, really at the end of the summer, and I was like, yeah, I'm going home tomorrow. They're like, oh, well, do you want to do this today? I'm like, sure, let's do it. So, yeah, good times. And I really enjoy doing commentary a lot. I learned so much watching those guys. It's hard when you know that the players are just on another level and you're supposed to comment on their play. I'm just like, he's great at poker. That's why he's doing that. He's doing that because I don't know why, but it's really good, whatever he did.
I forget who was in third, but he was a really good player, too. I forget his name.
I'm blanking on that,
European,
too.
European, but he was great, too. I feel like we're not giving him credit, but he played really well, too, and... That was like a couple
it was
hours.
Really high level final table.
Yeah,
it was great, and it was actually during the heads up of the main event that was going on at the same time, if I'm not mistaken, or at least the final six. It might have been the day before the heads up, but yeah, that was pretty exciting. And actually, people can check that out. It's free on Twitch.tv/PokerCentral, so you can look for it on there and see that coverage. And then you can find me on Twitter at Clayton Comic and tell me how bad my commentary was, which I always appreciate. It's always good to hear from people how much you suck. But I'm a thick-skinned stand-up comedian, so I can handle it. All right, guys, so let's get into the ESPN coverage that recently started airing. I think it's pretty safe to assume Andrew hasn't watched it. What about you, Mark? Have you checked out? You
know, I watched all the live streams, so no, I haven't watched any of the stuff on now, but I've basically seen it all.
Yeah, so what they've done is they've basically taken they've kind of gone back to what they used to do, where they're not really getting too obsessive about stack sizes and strategy tips, and there's no, so far at least, there's no like Phil Hellmuth white magic segment where they break down a hand and Phil Hellmuth gives everybody you know, ridiculous advice and everything. It's just really, it's more like a reality show. They're focusing on the personalities. They're really following Kelly Minkin very closely. You know, they always want to have a last woman standing. That's so important. I'm rather thrilled to see how much camera time I've gotten. They've been showing me quite a bit. And it gives Norman Chad a lot of opportunity to make to take jabs at me.
Yeah, they're kind of invested in you at this point. I mean, you're part of their brand now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because I did some commentary for them over the summer. So, yeah, I guess that's part of what they're doing is, you know, trying to convince people that I have a personality. So it's really fun to see, especially there was one hand in particular that I swear to God, my mother, who's also a poker player, was in town on day five. And there was a hand from day five that I was so worried that I had been bluffed. It was a really big pot for a lot of my stack, and I had I don't remember the details of, you know, exactly what cards came out or whatever, but I just remember, I hope he didn't bluff me. I hope he didn't bluff me, and I hope they show the hand on TV. And then when they actually do show the hand on the TV and you realize that you were not bluffed and that you actually folded the second best hand, it's like the best feeling. I know most players will never get a chance to have that feeling, because how many times you play a hand and you say, I wonder if he bluffed me, and then you actually get to see it right there on the screen. Nope, he had two pair.
Well, and the thing is, so many people beg in those situations. You know, like, tell me, did you have it? Did you have it? But even when they tell you, you still can't be sure.
Yeah.
Like, I lie to people in that situation all the time.
Yeah, of course. So most of us do. My standard answer is, if somebody says, did you have me beat? I say, if I tell the truth, will you believe me?
I've offered money at the table before, successfully and unsuccessfully. Like, it used to cause me a lot of pain where it was worth 20-30 bucks. Like, it was so funny too, because like $20 would get it done in the main event to see someone's hand in like a big spot, and I was like, wow, how much really? And I always ask myself, I was like, how much would I have paid to know what he had there? And like 20 bucks felt like a steal. But yeah, it can be painful. I probably would like it if it was recorded so I could see it after.
Yeah, it's nice to just be able to confirm that you made a good play, or even just to find out that I shouldn't have folded. You know, either way, just to, because there's so many hands in my head over my course of my career where I'm like, I wonder if he had it. I mean, that's why we try to think, you know, just GTO, you know, it doesn't matter whether he had it or not. Did I make a good play or not based on his range, not on what particular cards he had that time? But let's be honest. In the moment, you're like, does he have it or not, especially in live?
Yeah. I love the footage on you was hilarious, because you were the only – when they focused on your table, you were the only one having a good time, and everyone else looked miserable.
Yeah.
Clayton's actually enjoying himself while everyone else is so mad. I'm like, it's day five, like six. Like you should be happy or at least more awake.
Yeah, I do. People don't want to give anything away. There's a lot of advice out there, people telling each other to wear – sunglasses and hoodies and keep your mouth shut, don't give anything away. But
I don't pick up many tells as probably like Andrew does, where if I'm playing with Andrew and we're like two tables for a bracelet, like I don't want to give off anything to Andrew. Like he could maybe see me frown wrong and be like, oh, I call you, don't have it. You know, that's a little bit extreme, but I don't know, like I feel like glasses, I don't know, I feel like there's a little bit of an edge. Like, why would you want someone to look in your eyes? Like,
Well, I'll go one step further with you, Mark. I think they should outlaw glasses and hoodies and make us look at each other because I feel like that should be part of the game.
Yeah, I would be okay with that because I really do think it is an edge. But since they don't do it, I'm going to continue to wear stuff.
You're not breaking any rules.
Stuff, like wearing scarves and stuff, like if your neck pulsates, like when you're nervous and stuff. I mean, these are all things that I would never even consider. Like, I mean, I've looked at people's faces and been like, wow, he does not look happy right now. Like, it looks like he's bluffing. I feel he's bluffing. But, yeah, I don't know. I would be okay with that. I wouldn't, like, throw a temper tantrum. But since it's not outlawed, I'm going to continue to wear the stuff.
Andrew, what do you think if I outlaw scraggly beards? Would you be okay with that?
I don't have a scraggly beard. I have a stately beard.
I would go so far as to say a sexy beard. Nobody has a better beard than Brokus.
You're too kind.
No, but what do you think of my idea about getting rid of the sunglasses and the hoodies and as, at least for televised events? What do you think about that?
It's an interesting. I mean, I guess I would prefer to have fewer rules, all things equal. I'm a little libertarian in that sense. It doesn't strike me as a big problem. I may be underestimating that. I mean, it actually seems to me, as much as there's a stereotype of like pros wearing hoodies and sunglasses, it actually seems to me like it's primarily amateur. Like these days when I see someone in sunglasses, I think it's amateurs more often than professionals. And I mean, some of that is sort of like imitating what they think a poker player should look like or something. So maybe, you know, getting rid of that rule gets rid of people's desire to wear them. But I know that when I was new to, and I don't wear them now, but when I was new to live poker, you know, when I was primarily an online player and I didn't have a lot of experience trying to be stoic or whatever, I did wear them, and I don't know how much it actually mattered, but it made me feel more comfortable, and it also made me more comfortable staring my opponents down. You know, it's naturally, it's an uncomfortable thing to do, to stare very intensely at somebody. I mean, that's sort of a sign of aggression that in normal, polite society would not be okay.
Yeah, it's so weird to do that. Like, Mike McDonald stares, like, I could never do that, like, ever. Like, that's another reason I love the glasses, too, because I can literally just stare at him for, like, a minute. Like, but, like, really eye to eye, I'm just like, okay, this is weird. Like, I can't do this.
Yeah, I think it makes people more comfortable, you know, especially like newer, less experienced players. I'm certainly in favor of that.
Yeah, we need to welcome as many new players into the game as possible, which is why I think it was a good idea to have so much poker on Twitch over the summer. And you could tell from the chat in, you know, how Twitch, there's a chat box on the Twitch page, how many players or how many viewers were on with poker. I mean, they were asking very basic questions. Now, some of them were, you know, like talking about GTO and stuff like that. But a lot of the chat was, you know, Twitch is mostly a platform for video gamers. And they happen to find, oh, look, it's poker. Let me watch this. And they'd be like, you know, is this the main event? Do they get to keep the money? Are they really playing? Is this live? Like questions that anyone that was, you know, kind of, you know, in the poker world would know the answers to. So you could tell that we were in some way attracting some new fans to poker, which might inspire some of them to, you know, start playing a little bit, and maybe we can start, you know, a revolution of fresh new players in the game, which obviously, you know, we say all the time that we desperately need, and then they almost break the record with the main event turnout. So I don't know which way.
Yeah, that was the craziest thing of the summer to me. I was like, wow, like, I mean, I was like, I know a bunch of states were regulated, but that couldn't have had that big of an effect on the field size. I was shocked, and I was happy, obviously.
I was really pretty bearish on the turnout for 4th of July. That was a surprise to me.
Yeah, I didn't like that at all. I thought that was a really bad idea, but I guess what do I know?
Yeah.
Just shows either a lot of foreigners played that day or just a lot of us don't love our country enough.
I would say playing poker is a pretty damn American thing to do.
That's right, and that's why it should be legal online in all 50 states, and I hope they get that going. Boy, that was fun back in the day when we used to play online against the whole world. I know.
Oh, gosh.
They even had satellites in New Jersey for tournaments in Vegas, which was really cool. So we're getting, you know, slowly but surely one step closer.
Clayton, you're in Southern California, right?
No, I do spend a lot of time there, but I actually live in New York City.
You live in, Andrew, did you move from, are you in San Francisco or are you back in Maryland? Where are you now?
I'm literally in Maryland right now, but I'm not really formally located anywhere. This just happens to be where I am at the moment.
Yeah, because I'm hoping, California, like...
That would be huge.
It represented like 80% of poker stars when it was around. Like, we could field our own Sunday Million. Like, California would be gigantic. And, like, you know, just being – I feel like it's not close, but it should be. I would just be so happy. It would be so nice to get, like, a 1099 form from, like, poker, whatever the site is.
Yeah, that would be pretty awesome. And I feel like we're drifting into fantasy land now, but maybe not. You know, it could happen. It could happen. One step at a time, they're getting it. I feel like a lot of people are invested on both sides. And when I say invested, I mean their lobbyists are paying off the Congress people to vote how they want them to. They're literally investing in what they think is best. Yeah, lots of investments are being made. So I want to talk about a couple of the hands that they showed on ESPN over the weekend when the new episodes premiered. But before I do that, I want to see if you guys have any videos for the Tournament Poker Edge, the TPE website. Andrew, I know you've been pretty active in recent months. Have you been making videos about your WCOOP or anything else?
I do have some WCOOP. That, honestly, that's like part of the reason I played WCOOP is to get, you know, it's just hard. Like live poker, you don't get in that many hands and you have to recreate the hand histories from scratch if you want to talk about a lot of hand histories. So really part of the reason that I traveled for WCOOP was specifically to generate TPE content. So I do have some stuff I'm looking forward to reviewing. I'm actually, what I'm putting together right now is footage. Well, I say footage. I mean, it's hands that I played during the summer of 2018, you know, WSOP and also Venetian and whatever else I was playing. But in a lot of cases, it was actually footage that I recorded very soon after the tournaments were over. So, you know, when I have a hand that I decide for my own purposes I want to look into further using software or whatever, you know, I'll just kind of take down those notes and I try to address it immediately if it's something that I think is going to be relevant for future tournaments as well. Like, this is a spot I would like to know more about for whatever I'm going to play tomorrow. I'm sort of supplementing it with stuff that I'm recording now, but literally just today I was working on that.
Very cool. How about you, Mark? What is your activity level on TPE these days?
Most of it has been just reviewing a lot of Derek's stuff. Derek's been playing really well, and he recently had a run in the 2K on one of the American sites, so we'll be reviewing that soon. I'm definitely more coaching these days than actually playing. I still love playing live, but online I don't play nearly as much as I used to. So, yeah, the stuff with Derek has been really fun because it's really refreshing for me, and he's playing so well that seeing his improvements, I mean, we've been doing it for years, and he's gotten so much better. And, like, this run in the 2K should be really interesting, so I'm excited about it.
Yeah,
I do want to say I love what Andrew's doing because, like, Gus Hansen's book, I mean, everyone thinks Gus Hansen, you can't learn anything. I loved Gus Hansen's book, and it's, I mean, he didn't use software to go over his hands, but it was a really good, like, I liked knowing what he was thinking in certain spots and why he did stuff. So I think the live, bringing it to, like, a review online is pretty cool, or even in a book.
Year I played in the Aussie Millions main event, it was the year after he wrote that book, which is about him winning the Aussie Millions. If anyone hasn't read it, I recommend Every Hand Revealed by Gus Hansen. So I'm flying to Australia. I got a 14-hour flight from L.A. to Sydney. And on the way there, I'm actually reading how Gus Hansen played in and won the Aussie Millions. I busted day one, but still, it was a great book. Andrew, what did you want to say a second ago?
I was going to say, yeah, I like that book a lot also, and I think it actually is kind of underappreciated. You know, I know that there was stuff when I read that book that seemed bad to me at the time, and one of those things was how wide he was calling from the big blind. I mean, this is a book that was published like 2007 or something.
This is way before, before the big blind defend strategy.
Yeah, I was like, Queen 7? what's he doing? Maybe if you really can read over your opponents, but I don't know. That seems crazy to me. And now, of course, it's like completely standard.
Yeah, what has become standard, the backgammon guys knew all along because, you know, players like Gus Hansen and Dan Harrington were defending their big blinds pretty wide, you know, many years ago. I think it's mostly because they always had a math-based, you know, I'm getting these incredible pot odds, so I'm going to call. But we all said, well, we're going to be out of position with Queen 7. What good does it do me to have 7-1 pot odds now if I have to play Queen 7? And maybe some of us have taken it too far. I mean, I know I probably defend a little too wide myself from the big blind. But, yeah, I think it's interesting how things come and go. You know, for a while there, we were all min-raising all the time, and that's pretty much stopped as far as I could tell over the summer.
Well, I mean, that's because people are defending their big blinds correctly.
Yeah, we can't be getting flatted all the time.
Right. It's the ebb and flow of the game, which is what makes it so extremely cool. Well, great. Yeah, so check out tournamentpokeredge.com. Get your – I know a lot of people that listen to the podcast aren't members. Obviously, it's a very, very affordable, very, very great just chock full. There's no way you could get through all the information on TPE. I would challenge anyone to get through all the videos on TPE or all the videos on Poker Go before they die. You're not going to do it.
I'll take your side, too.
Yeah, I'll lay odds, really high odds. All right, so let's talk about these ESPN broadcasts. I intentionally chose hands that I'm not involved in, even though they show me quite a bit.
Oh, we wanted to berate you.
I know, but you know, the truth is, if you check out my website, you can see all the podcasts that I've been on, where I pretty much talked about all the hands they've shown already. So that's why I didn't want to repeat hands. You know, for anyone that's listened to my other podcasts, including Thinking Poker, Andrew, we can plug your amazing podcast. It's called Thinking Poker. Andrew Brokus, Nate
Davis.
Because
of our guests.
That's right. That's right. I've been on 4 times for the record. Really great show, and everybody should check that out too as soon as this one's over. All right, so this is a hand from day 5. The players are Kelly Minkin on the button, and the big blind, which is a player named Jekyll. So let's just kind of look at this hand together. It's the blinds were 30K, 60K with a 10K ante. So our starting pot is 180. Kelly... It's folded to Kelly on the button, and she only has 1.6 million. And she's holding the King of Diamonds and the 8 of Clubs. So is this a spot for a button raise or a button shove? I don't think anyone's folding. Let's start with you, Mark.
Did you say, what was Jekyll's stock?
Yeah, I didn't actually say. I should have said he's got her well covered. He's got about 5 million.
And she has 1.6 million at 60K BB?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in the main event, day 5, I'm just opening. Yeah, I would just open. Shoving would be 10. I mean, shoving's fine. It depends a lot on jumps and stuff like that and what I thought of the big blind and the small blind. I think if we ran it, like, shoving is definitely 100% fine. I think, like, if he's not defending properly, you know, 2.2, 2.3x, something like that.
Yeah. So if we know that if we, you know, put this hand into snap shove or whatever other tournament tool we want to use, it's going to be plus EV to shove. Why not shove?
Well, I just want to I value my tournament life a bit more in the main event, especially this deep.
Yeah, there's probably about 400 players left at this point, maybe 300. So it's
and
not like
although it's plus EV to shove, like it doesn't mean that opening doesn't have a higher EV. So yeah, I mean, in fact, like it's kind of a lot to shove. Yeah, I mean, I know
it's 20 more than 20 blinds, right?
Yeah, it's 1.6.
Yeah, it's about 20.
I mean, yeah. I definitely think opening has a higher expectation than shoving. Shoving, you're still making money, but I mean, with tournament life and like the fact that I think opening is actually more profitable. Like, yeah, I'm just gonna open.
Yeah, I agree, Andrew.
I was going to say, I don't know, there's not a lot of shoving that I do for over 20 big blinds, especially not just, you know, open shoving, especially not this deep in the main event. I think there's a lot of reasons not to. With this, I don't think this is a particularly appealing open limping candidate, and I don't do a lot of open limping the button either, but yeah, I guess I wouldn't take that completely off the table. I wouldn't be surprised if there were people who had done some work on open limping in late position. This doesn't strike me as the most obvious hand. Like, I think you'd probably want a hand that benefits a little bit more from seeing a flop to do that, like a 9-7 suited.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well.
Yeah, I'll do that too.
Yeah, so I think I would. I'm with Mark to just make a you know, small, what I would call standard open.
Let me ask both of you, because I feel like there are some hands that are good shoves, like specifically just the bottom pairs.
If I were to shove anything, it would be those very smallest pairs.
Yeah, I think I'd probably put like an ace king, ace queen in that shoving range as well. You got about 20.
Strong. You want to induce shoves with that. I mean, when I have ace queen, I want to be raised calling. I don't want to be just open jamming.
That's why we open the king eight for when we open the ace queen. You know, we want to have that. We want to be opening pretty wide from the button, so we need to have like the top of our range in our opens, like, so we can get shoved on.
Kelly decides to open to 130. So that's just above a min raise, which you do see late in the main event, where the standard open does become basically a min raise, because everyone is protecting their tournament lives so dearly that you don't really need to raise much more than that, even when the ante is one third of the small blind, which, going back to Gus Hansen's book, that means that it's much more valuable to steal as opposed to when it's one fifth. So anyway, she opens to 130. The small blind folds, as I already kind of foreshadowed that he would. And Jekyll calls in the big blind. Now, the problem with watching a hand on TV just in a vacuum is you don't really know what the dynamics are, what the, you know, personality types are the players. They have mentioned that Kelly's been really active at the table and that she's, you know, really trying to kind of get back in the tournament. Her stack is like one third of average, so she's trying to get back into contention, as it were. So he calls for 70 more, and I don't want to say what he had. So I was just going to play this hand from Kelly's perspective. So the flop comes ace of hearts, queen of hearts, tray of spades, and Jekyll checks. If you were Kelly, you don't have a heart. There are two hearts on the flop. Would you bet or check, Andrew?
I would probably err on the side of betting. I think it's a difficult board, especially at this stack size. I think there's a really big range advantage here, even though she's a button raiser and she can have quite a wide range. I think there's a lot of ace-x that the big blind is going to be just jamming with. If he has even like ace-9 or something, you know, it's pretty appealing to just ship it there as opposed to call. So I think it's really difficult for him to... I just think she has way more ace-x in her range. The kind of hand I'd be more inclined to check back is a hand that has a little bit more showdown value. I think, although there's a decent chance that king high is good here, you know, A, it's very vulnerable, it can easily be drawn out on, and B, it's not really a strong enough hand where I want to check back and then face bets. Honestly, even if I improve the hand to, you know, a pair of eights or even a pair of kings, I'm not that excited about facing two bets after I check back. So I don't think there's a whole lot of value in checking back. I think we lose the pot pretty often when we check back, and I think that, you know, just betting immediately is pretty likely to have a good EV. I don't think a very large bet is required.
Okay, so the pot is 380. You have like another 1.5 in your stack. What kind of sizing would you go with here?
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 100K, like a quarter of the pot. I really think a small... I mean, I'm not really trying to make the guy fold even a better hand than king high. I'm not expecting to fold. But I think just getting him to fold... I just think he's going to fold enough that's immediately profitable. And, you know, king eight does have a decent amount of equity, certainly against bottom pair. Even against a queen, you have the live king. I'm kind of just betting primarily to clean up equity, although I think you will get some barreling opportunities. You can turn gut shots with this hand.
Sure. Mark, what do you want to add?
Nothing. He said it perfectly. I'm trying to think of some hands I would definitely check back. Like, I don't know. Like, Andrew, what are you doing with King Jack and King 10? I think I'm still leaning towards betting them, but I think if we check back those gutters, it's not horrible. But I'm with him. Like, most of the Ace X's are reshipping, so we bet a quarter of the pot. Yeah, I think there's so much out there where it's so important to our stack where I'd rather not allow many cards to improve.
Well, and the main liability of betting a hand like King Jack or King 10 is getting check raised, right? Getting check called is not a big deal when you have those hands.
Yeah.
I think this is a very difficult board for him to check raise. You know, he'll have, a hand like a queen, or he'll have hands like King Jack and King 10 himself, maybe. And those, I don't expect him to fold those, certainly.
Well, there are two hearts on the board, too.
That's true. I guess he can check shove hearts.
But yeah, we block a shit ton with King Jack and King 10.
Yeah.
That some of his check raise hands.
And with this hand, you're saying if you have King Jack or King 10, it's
close. Yeah, I mean, I'm still betting them like 80-90% of the time anyway.
Yeah, I would say Jacks is probably like the single hand I'm most likely to check.
What about some Ace X? Are you checking back any Ace X here?
Yeah, I think weak Ace X are pretty good checks also.
Yeah, cool.
Now, if you had that King Jack or King 10, guys, do you feel like betting around 100K with those hands is also... would you want to keep your sizing consistent? You ask a leading question, Andrew, but would you bet the same amount with those hands?
I would, and that's not even to say, like, I think there could be a case for having some hands that bet larger on this board, but I don't think King Jack or King 10 are good to include in that range. Again, the real liability with those hands is getting check raised, and I think particularly at these stack sizes, I'm not even sure this is theoretically correct, but I think it is how a lot of people play, that if you bet a small amount, people will peel, and I don't think they really expand their check raising range that much compared to how much they're going to check raise if you bet a larger amount. If you bet a larger amount, I think people tend to err more on the side of check shoving or check folding, and they don't do as much check calling as your bet gets larger, particularly when a shove is only like a pot-sized bet or not much more than a pot-sized raise. And that's what we really don't want with King Jack or King 10. Those are hands that have a lot of equity against wide calling ranges, which is what we're going to get if we bet a small amount. And they're hands that are not going to be able to call a shove and are not going to be in good shape against the range of hands that calls a larger bet. So what we're doing by making a larger bet really is we're hurting our equity, among other things. We're going to be in worse shape when a large bet is called, like much worse shape when a large bet is called than when a small bet is called. I think I would want a much weaker hand or a much stronger hand than King Jack or King 10 to make a larger bet. Like, I'd want to be more polarized.
If you're like me and you're listening to Andrew, you're thinking, I need to start watching this guy's videos.
I've said it forever. Like, sorry to cut you off, but yeah, I'm with you 100%. He puts out the best stuff by far on TV.
You should feel free to cut him off to say things like that.
All right, so Kelly kind of goes with Andrew here. She bets 95K into the 380K pot, which is, very small bet.
Smart lady, that Kelly Macon.
Yeah, except that she gets check raised by Jekyll into 265. So, what kind of range are we putting him on? First question. And second question, what should Kelly do after getting check raised here? Let's start with you this time, Mark.
Well, to me, this kind of looks polar, like it's a stone nuts or it's a bluff. Like, I really don't think it's hearts. I think hearts just jams. Oh, God, I'm trying. Hearts jams. Yeah. Guess this could be... No, I don't think he check raises like 10 jack and stuff like that. So yeah, I think this is like two pair or just a complete air ball. And two pair is pretty rare. Queen threes, maybe some ace threes. Yeah, I'd probably defend ace three as opposed to reshipping it and just reship like the ace six through ace nine. So yeah, this is super polar to me. Nuts or nothing. Hearts, I don't think it's hearts. I think hearts shoves. There's just too much, or hearts shoves or calls, I should say. I don't think raises to this size. Although I don't think that's bad.
What's the worst hand that you would consider nuts, Mark? When you say nuts or nothing, like what's sort of the weakest hand that you would think of as being part of the nuts that he might check this?
As far as the value stuff, like, yeah, two pair.
Queen three?
Yeah, queen three, yeah. Like, ace three? Oh, God. Yeah. Have I check raise ever here? I mean, some people will check raise ace three, but yeah, I think queen three.
I guess I'm thinking, you know, let's... It really depends on, do we think he's jamming a hand like ace 10 preflop? If not, I think that's a... I don't know. Would you, is like, suppose he got here with ace 10. Do you think that's not check raising?
No. But I don't hate that. Like, because it kind of looks bluffy. So we might get shoved on with air. I mean, I guess I'm just... With how I play, I would just check call there and hopefully they barrel off because, I don't know, depending on this player, like, he's going to be pretty wide out of the big blind, especially since he's actually shorter because the shorter people get, the wider we're supposed to defend just because of no reverse implied odds.
In my experience playing live, a check raise is hardly ever one pair.
I kind of like it, though. Andrew, the ace-10 check raise is kind of sick. It's kind of... It's something I don't do.
I would guess if we were to put this into Pio Solver, we would see a check raise range in the neighborhood of, like, 20 to 25% from the big blind. I don't think anybody plays that way, that certainly includes myself.
Yeah.
I think in theory, he's supposed to be check raising here a lot. I think any ace in his shoes is going to be good enough to check raise get in. That's not to say that he's always check raising. Like, I think it's going to be a mix with most, if not all, of his ace X. But with stacks being as shallow as they are and both players' ranges being as wide as they are, you know, he doesn't need a good ace for it to be a hand that's strong enough to check raise get in. I don't think that people check raise all that much in this, and you know, particularly given how small she bet, right? He's not risking very much. She's betting 100k into 300k, into 400k. So there's almost 500k in the pot when he raises, and he's only risking like 2.7 or something. You know,
yeah,
like his bluffs,
five, yeah.
His bluffs just don't need to succeed that often. You know, she should be calling the raise with a lot of hands that are worse than you know, a pair of aces.
Yeah, definitely. I think she should call with any piece if she has a queen. Yeah, I mean, she needs to call a lot just because the same great price he's giving himself. Yeah.
King Jack, King Tanner probably calls for her, at least according to
Pia. Oh, yeah, it should be.
Yeah, they should be because, yeah, she probably has a live king a lot of the time. If he's playing ideally, GTO.
King Jack High is good a fair amount of the time.
Yeah, it's probably, good a lot. Given all that, do you think she should call this with her king?
Let me ask Andrew something real quick. So you don't think he is check raising like one pair aces here? Although, like, I agree that Pio is going to tell us to do it X amount of the time. I'd say, I mean, without knowing him, if you just guessed, I mean, you wouldn't assume that.
Given that I don't recognize his name, you know, I guess if he had the look of, there's plenty of like great non-American players now that I wouldn't recognize, but you can sort of look at them and you can tell, okay, is this a 24-year-old from Estonia? Then yeah, he probably knows that he's supposed to check raise those hands. Like, there's not $10,000 floating around in the hands of a lot of 24-year-old Estonians. Like, if they are in the main event, it's because they have a positive expectation.
Yes. So, are you kind of, do you agree that it's pretty polar to, like, the nuts or, like, a nuttier type hand, two pair?
I think from someone air? Who hasn't been, you know, doing solver work, yeah, and I think that's likely the case with this guy, but I also think...
And what about hearts? Never? Like, hearts, it doesn't seem like, I don't know, like...
Not unless
could be
it's,
wrong.
Like, a pair plus hearts. I'm sure,
like,
he's supposed to be doing it with some hearts, but I don't think you see that from a lot of people. I think you see the check shove more often. People want to just get it in. They don't want to check raise and face a 3-bet, or check raise and then you get peeled and see a blank turn. Those are uncomfortable spots that people just want to avoid.
Would it change your mind at all if I told you he's about 35 and from Argentina?
I feel a lot better about thinking that he's polar on the check raise.
All right. Great, because those are the
I would say the more that I think he's going to be capable of check raise bluffing, the less inclined I am to bet this hand. because I do think this is also a hand that suffers from getting, I mean, not as much as King Jack or King 10, but I wouldn't really want to bet fold this hand against someone that I think is going to check raise bluff too much, but I don't know that I would really want to check raise call with, or bet call with it either. So if I were going to be inclined to call, I might just not bet the flop in the first place.
I think Kelly was probably surprised to get check raised on this board because, like us, she deduced that he doesn't have that many aces, and then she probably didn't expect him to be able to check raise her. But, you know, you got to remember, he's got her well covered, and he's giving himself a great price. And also, you know, she doesn't have to have an ace, and she probably can't continue in his mind.
And for people her like to take shots at women.
Yeah. She down bet it, too. She only bet 95. Now, Andrew, you say that you don't think people adjust their check raise frequency for those small bets. But, and that's probably true of, you know, live players in general. But I would personally go after this 95 a lot more than I would, say, a 150, just because it's so much cheaper for me to try to win this pot with a little cute little check raise like the one, you know, Mr. Jekyll did here.
And I keep coming back to the, like, I think people don't, like, there is ego that gets involved when you bet a quarter of the pot.
Who's this guy trying to win this pot?
Like, it's not a guy either. Silly. Like, I think this is actually a kind of big deal the more I think about it. I think in particular the, like, getting bluffed by a woman and getting bluffed by a woman for a tiny bet size, I think there are people for whom that's going to be a trigger.
With five ESPN cameras and, like, all these lights on you? Yeah, Andrew, yeah, I agree.
The more we talk about this, yeah, the more this seems like...
There are a lot of people who feel that way, and a lot of those people come from Argentina. So.
Yeah, I was debating whether to say that myself, but yeah, I don't think 35-year-old Argentinian is counting against the...
the argument, yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe Kelly sniffed that out, too, because she shoved, you know, with no pair, no draw. She just has the king eight, and she puts in the rest of her chips and wins the pot. So
I don't know about shoving as opposed to just calling. I mean, yeah, you're letting him realize equity with his bluffs, but your hand is doing it. Like, when he calls, she's drawing damn near dead.
Yeah, especially if we don't think it's ever hearts. I was thinking in my head, I was like, well, she could be ahead of some hearts. But yeah.
Well, I think the big check raise bluff with the hearts is probably the play that most of us would do. As you pointed out earlier, Mark, you know, I
may check jam hearts or check call. I don't really check raise hearts here, but that's a mistake in my game because, yeah, I mean, when PO speaks, we listen.
Yeah, of course.
I have had some of, like, if I had any of the combo pairs, like if I had Queen X of heart, I would be fine check raising small, getting that in.
Yeah, well, you can't have Queen X of hearts, but I know what you mean.
Oh, it's Ace Queen of hearts three. Okay, Ace Queen.
Three X of hearts is a pretty good check raise check hand, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that too.
Especially since your threes have wheel. I mean, you could check raise that, and then you could jam any deuce or four, too, or, like, any deuce, four, or five.
Yeah. So let me reveal what Andres Jekyll had. He had the 10-7 offsuit. So I think his defend from the big blind is fine. Mm-hmm. I think looking at the small size on the flop, he decided to just take a stab, knowing that she is less likely to have king 10, as with the hand that you guys kept mentioning. King 10 that might bet 95, so maybe, you know, he felt like he had a blocker to one of her possible hands.
You could check raise 100% here in this exact spot versus the field, like to his exact sizing, and I bet it's profitable.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, I actually like it. If he's doing it because she's a woman, that's silly, but I think it's good here because it puts a shit ton of pressure on her. I mean, she's, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much, it's 265K and that you're done with it. You know, you're not continuing. Like, if she calls, like, you're just done. I don't hate
it. Yeah, you're done no matter what she does.
Does he have a heart?
Yeah. No, No, he didn't have any backdoor.
It's way better to have a heart in your hand, even just one. Not even so much because of the backdoor, but it blocks her having
heart. It takes away her having heart, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because if she has a flush draw of any kind, she's going with it, of course.
Yeah, I mean, she's not folding it anyway.
Right. So many more combos, too, taken away if we have one. It's crazy.
Yeah, even if it's a bad heart is still a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I bet you that's how PO balances. I actually know, pretty sure that's how it works.
Yeah, it's all about removal and, you know, combinatorics. So, yeah. That was a fun one. Any other
thoughts? Props to Kelly for that. That takes balls. Like, good for her.
Yeah, I mean, she is the illest, as we all know. I played with her in a Venetian event. We both kind of lasted up until dinner of one of the Venetian events. And, I mean, she's a force at the table. She gets in there. She's not afraid to get involved in pots. She's also super cool and confident and just, like, kind of got this quiet calm to her that, you know, I find it's intimidating when players are just really comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, not hiding, not scared, not worried about what you think. They don't seem to ever sweat anything. It's just, you know, she's just in there doing her job and playing the game. So, yeah, props to her. It was fun watching her play and go really deep again. What did she get, like 65th or something? So, pretty cool. Do you guys have time for another hand or should we wrap?
I'm game.
Yeah, I'm good. Let's go.
All right, cool. So let's move on to day six. All right, I want to do this hand from the perspective of an Eastern European player named Sersev. So we are going to talk about day six. It's 50K, 100K with a 10K ante. So there's 240K in the pot. We have 2.7 million. So our M is 11. And we have 27 big blinds.
Oh, so you're getting me excited. Bringing up M. Getting me excited.
I like M. I'm an M guy. And
I was M forever, and now it's actually back. I like both, but M is outstanding.
M is going to be even more important as tournament structures change and there's more big blind ante than there used to be. And they're kind of playing, a lot of tournaments are playing with not having the big blind always be two times the small blind. So then just knowing how much is in the pot is going to be more important than ever rather than just taking the shortcut of carrying, just counting how many big blinds you have. Because
I was
going to
say that a lot of the TP community probably doesn't know what M is. It's old Dan Harrington reference. But, yeah, go ahead and explain more.
Yeah, sure. M is super easy. A lot of us are familiar with SPR, which is your stack-to-pot ratio on the flop. Well, your M is your stack-to-pot ratio before the flop. So I don't know why the whole poker world is all on board with SPR on the flop, but they don't think about it before the flop. But I think it's just because for most of us, it's just easier to count the blinds.
It's called people being lazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guilty of that too. I used M for the first part of my career, and then I was like, big blinds is so much easier.
It's way easier.
M's way better.
Yeah, M is more precise, and I tend to be a precise guy, so I will be talking M on this podcast. You guys can send me all the hate mail you want. It's not going to stop. All right. So we are in what you call late middle position nowadays. So not the high jack, not the low jack. Yeah, actually, this was the low jack. Okay. So I'm in the low jack, as I'm saying I'm Sersev, the hero in the hand. And the player on our immediate right opens from late middle, whatever you want to call that position. He makes it 220, and he's got 6.5 million. Doesn't really matter because we only have 2.7 million, and we're holding the king-queen offsuit, king of diamonds, queen of spades. So we're in the low jack with king-queen facing an open. Now, the player who's opening has been fairly active at the table. He's a young guy. He's got a patch on him that says best bet Jacksonville, which we've seen this patch all over the place throughout this main event. It seems like at every table I've been to that I've seen at least one of these patches. It seems like Jacksonville sent 1,000 players to the main event for some reason this year. Or maybe it's just, you know, just my luck of the draw or whatever. He's a young guy, very excited and emotional. He's got an average stack late on day six in the main event. There's about, I don't know, let's say there's maybe 90 players left. It's getting pretty late. So on our left is a mostly tight table with the exception of the player who's currently in the cutoff, who's been in virtually every pot and seems like a total fish.
What about stack sizes to our left?
Yeah,
so, the fact that they're tight is good, but yeah, if there's reship stacks, that's going to change how and we all play the hand.
Yeah, so the guy that's a few spots to our left in the cutoff, his name is Rianne, and he is one of the chip leaders in the tournament right now with about 12 million. The other stacks are in the same range as the guy who's opening, or around between 5 and 7 million. So nobody's really, really that deep, but okay. We do have a chip leader at the table.
And no short stacks.
No. We are the shortest stack at the table right now. And the opener it has about an average stack. So let me go first, and you guys can tell me if I suck at poker. I just fold this hand. I mean, I think my stack is too short to really, like, you know, try to see a flop. And you know, God knows what's about to happen behind me. I don't like three betting because I'm going to be too committed. If the original raiser shoves, I'm probably going to make it a bad fold a lot when I lay it down. I don't think this is a spot to play king queen. What do you think, Mark? Am I wrong?
I was wondering if I was going to. I was thinking about folding as well. I will say it's a. This is a tough hand to fold in general because. I mean, it's two face cards. It looks pretty. I probably lean towards folding here, folding or three betting. Yeah, because I kind of like three betting too. I would also want to, like, about the opener, if he had been opening a lot, that would determine what I do. I don't think flatting is bad. I'll say that right now.
Okay.
I probably flat, like, I was thinking about it. I definitely flat the button. Definitely flat the big and small blind. Even though we're out of position, just odds are better. And we know we have more information, like if people folded.
Yeah. You don't mind being in the low jack and just calling and then hoping all these guys behind you don't three bet?
Yeah, I'm probably leaning towards folding or three betting. And, I mean, like I said, I would flat later in position.
Okay.
Button cutoff, stuff like that.
All right. What about you, Andrew? Am I terrible for folding this? Am I playing too tight?
I'm certainly not going to say terrible. I would lean towards three betting. I guess I would say, do you think a three bet fold range in this spot? You know, is there any hand you would three bet fold?
I guess maybe if I felt like bluffing, but no, I think in this position, it's not really a good position to be in when you like take something like an 8-7 of clubs. Or something like that, and try to bluff with it.
Well, yeah, so that's I would certainly rather have this hand than 8-7 of clubs, right? So I guess what I'm envisioning is, I think if I had, you know, suppose I had pocket kings. It's not a terrible spot to flat with kings, but I think I would rather 3-bet it, and I don't really want to just shove it. So I think I would want to make a relatively small 3-bet with kings. Like I think there are strong hands that I'm going to want to play as a small 3-bet, even if I maybe would want to make a slightly larger 3-bet with like an ace king or ace queen. I'm not even saying I necessarily would, but I think with, you know, big pairs, for instance, I would want to make a kind of small 3-bet and sort of maximize the room that my opponent has to talk himself into 4-bet jamming. So I think there's no reason not, you know, unless I think that he's just going to be 4-betting too wide or something, but in a vacuum, I think that means I should have a 3-bet fold range as well. And I want to have, but I also think what's going to happen a lot, so he opened to like 2.2, is that right?
Yeah, correct.
So if we make it, say, 500,000, he should be calling that 3-bet a lot. And that's not really what we want, but as you said, you know, we also don't want to put a lot of chips in the pot and then fold to a shove. So I think making a small 3-bet, you just sort of accept, you know, you may not have a ton of fold equity, but you're also going to be ahead sometimes. Like, he's opening hands that are worse than king-queen. And if he does peel off, then that means you're going to be going to the flop with a very low stack to pot ratio. So 8-7 of clubs is not the hand you want to have in that situation. The hand you want to have in that situation is two big cards where you can just get a flop, you know, flop a pair. With 8-7, often when you flop a pair, it's still not a hand you really want to stack off with. With king-queen, when you flop a pair, it's usually top pair, and you can also get, you know, like a jack 10x flop or something that's very good for your hand. And yeah, I mean, you go to a flop with reasonable equity, you drive those other players out of the pot, you get a little pre-flop fold equity, build a little more post-flop fold equity in for yourself by representing a strong hand, and, you know, there's something like a third of the time you're going to flop a hand that's strong enough to get in, you block some of the hands that are going to four bet you. I think it's a pretty good small three-bet candidate.
Yeah, I agree with you. I guess, you know, while you were talking, I was trying to think if there are any hands that I would three bet fold in this spot off this stack at this position in the table. And I think the honest answer is no, I don't really have a three bet folding range. And I agree with you that I should, but I guess for me, a lot of the things I do, particularly in tournaments like the main event, are exploitable. And I think we just found one. So if I have, 27 big blinds and I three bet, I'm probably not folding.
I don't think it's a massive mistake to be folding here, at all. I don't like. I agree that I slightly three betting's probably better, but I don't think folding is horrible given like the 2 hour levels. Given the structure and what it is. I mean, I think so what are we doing with like ace 10? Same thing, right? Like, we can't flat. Like, I mean, I'd much rather flat king-queen. I mean, I would never flat. Probably never flatting in the spot with king-queen either. But, like, yeah, ace-10, like, if you don't have three-bet folds, then you're three, I guess, I mean, yeah, I mean, you're not going to be playing with these guys a million hands. I guess you can get away with it in just one tournament. I'd want to have some three-bet calls.
Yeah, I mean, I think the like, you're not going to be playing with them forever. It sort of ignores the fact that a lot of people don't have, like, Clayton's not the only person in the world who maybe doesn't have a three-bet fold range here. So I think, like, who knows with the opener whether he's going to fall in this category. But I think people don't necessarily need experience with you to predict this. I mean, kind of like we were doing in the previous hand where, you know, we didn't have any experience with that, the Argentinian. But we were just making assumptions based on our experience of poker players generally that we thought he was going to be unbalanced in that spot, and I think that a fair number of people are going to make the same correct guess in this situation and say a lot of people are just very strong when they three bet with this kind of effective stack size.
Yeah, and I guess that it forces those of us that are making that decision to play maybe tighter than we should, because when you mentioned ace 10, I think I would probably fold that too. I don't like being in this position again, you know, and the worst relative position against the opener, relative position meaning that I'm to his immediate left. I would like to have a really strong range when I get involved, especially with this stack size, because there's just such a strong likelihood that it's all going in.
Yeah, I much prefer three betting with king queen here just because of post flop playability.
Ace 10's a harder hand to play.
Yeah, but I would just use the blocker. I don't know, it's probably bad, but I would size it bigger just so I'm not pricing him to call. And that can be, like, people can destroy my face doing that. I would try to get away with it. Like, I may make it, like, 600,000 here just to discourage a call. And I know that's horrible, but if I felt I could get away with it in the main, and if I knew, I don't know, I may try it. Like, I don't know. I don't know. That seems super fishy. That seems super fishy to even say that, but
yeah,
that's a leak of mine.
Yeah, that's fine. We're finding leaks. We can start thinking about how to plug them. And I think, you know, three betting with a hand like king queen helps you balance when you do have a monster. So, yeah, obviously it makes sense for those reasons. And because, as Andrew said, most players are going to have a very strong range when they do three bet. I don't think most players would fold the hand, though. I think just the field in general is just going to flat with king queen here and see what happens.
Yeah, I just mean, don't basically like... everybody flats too much because it's the, like, easy thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, Andrew, would you flatten later? I think flatting in later position is fine, but here I don't particularly like it just because of how many people are left to act. Yeah, I agree. But like, I'm fine with it on the button and cutoff.
Yeah, I will say too. I think, you know, ace 10 was a good hand to bring up. Like, I think if you were to three bet small with every single appealing candidate for it, including like all of your big pairs and all of your like king queen, ace 10, blah blah blah, like you are gonna be unbalanced towards bluffs at that point. So I mean, I guess the answer to that in theory is, you know, it's a mix with hands like king queen and ace 10. In practice, what that usually means is just making a guess of, you know, do I want to always or never three bet those hands. But I think you want it to be an informed guess. You know, like, you want to be saying, I'm exploiting a particular thing about this opponent, and I feel comfortable about saying, you know, this, rather than, I would say, just like not even considering it. Like, my process is, first I imagine what would my bluffs be kind of in theory, and then I say, you know, what kind of deviation do I want to make from the theory, and the hands I'm most likely to deviate with are the ones that would be mixed at equilibrium.
Right. Man, let's just digest that for a minute. Just the brilliance.
So wait. Yeah.
Just give me a second to like swallow all that.
Are you saying like you think it's like okay to do 600,000 and like do that with aces too? Like,
or 500.
Yeah, maybe explain more for me and Clayton and everyone else.
So what's the question?
So. Yeah, I guess just go back to what you were talking about, ace 10, like, what, like, when you're varying sizes, if you are, or, like, would you just stay 500k, like, I'm not deviating from this, or will you 3-bet bigger with, like, aces and ace 10, like, to just balance the fact that you're discouraging calls with these weaker hands that play poorly post, and, like, your nut type hands, which I don't think is bad.
I would actually be, the hand I'd be most likely to 3-bet larger with is ace-king, where it's a hand that, so I think 3-betting larger, it may get you more folds, but I also think it gets you more shoves. Like, I think there might be some appeal a small 3-bet, but jam to a larger one. And so, you know, when I have aces, I want the calls. Like, I'm not, and I mean, I guess getting more shoves is good too, but you know, aces is not really the sort of, like, I'm more likely to use aces to balance my small through betting range if I'm going to be doing both. I think, you know, a hand like ace king, and then maybe the other one is, you know, that's, I guess ace 10 could be a reasonable candidate to maybe even split across all three. The point that I meant to make more was, like, I think there's a fair chance if, and I've not really done like pre-flop solver work, but I think there's a fair chance if we were to do that, we would see hands like ace 10 and king queen being a mix of three bets and folds. I really don't know how to guess whether we would see them in there as calls ever, but what that means, right, a mix of three bets and folds means that at equilibrium, three betting and folding have the same expected value, which is would have to be zero, since that's the expected value of folding. So in theory, if your opponent is also playing an equilibrium strategy, then three betting and folding are going to have the same expected value. What that also means, though, is that any small deviation on your opponent's part is going to determine how you play your hand. So, for instance, if your opponent is going to jam a little less than he should, and maybe fold a little more than he should, then all those hands that are a mix at equilibrium, those just become strictly three bets, because now
all
your opponent
bets,
is... Right. And those, you know, there's some hands, that doesn't just mean you three bet them with anything. Like, deuce four is not a mix at equilibrium. Deuce four is a strict fold. So even if we think he's folding a little bit more than he should at equilibrium, that doesn't mean we can just three bet with deuce four, but it does mean that a hand that's mixed at equilibrium, you know, that's a very sensitive balance, a very delicate balance, and so even a very small or minor change in the opponent's strategy will lead you towards a pure strategy rather than a mixed strategy.
Excellent. Fantastic. So in the cutoff, Mr. Rianne, who seems to be involved in every single pot at this table and appears to be a very inexperienced poker player, calls as well. So we end up seeing this flop with two opponents, and we all agree that Hero has made a mistake already by calling. So anyway, to reward his mistake, he flops the nuts, ace jack 10 with two clubs. We don't have a club. There is 900k in the pot, and the original raiser now bets 380 into the 900, and it's action on us holding the nut, the ace high straight, and we don't have a club. It's ace of diamonds, jack of clubs, ten of clubs. We have the king of diamonds and queen of spades. So, Mark, do you call or raise this 380?
I call 100% of the time.
Okay.
Just like our stack, given what's in the pot, it's not going to be tough to get it all. I'm trying to think of what bluffs I have here that would warrant a raise, and I don't have any, really. Yeah, I'm just calling here. I'm trying to think if I have any bluffs. I don't have any bluffs.
There's a third player in the pot, right? You said the button called also?
Yeah, the cutoff called, yeah.
I'm sorry. That does change stuff.
Well, I was going to say, I think that makes it even harder to raise as a bluff. Like, I think that makes the original raider's, his c-betting hand is just, his range is pretty strong, and, you know, this is a board that, with the exception of king-queen, you're going to be pretty capped on. Like, your aces, your jacks, your tens, those are three-betting pre-flop. I think this is a very difficult spot to raise as a bluff, and I also think people probably tool out a little too much when you call. Like, I think especially if the cutoff we think is a little fishy, that's more reason to call. I agree with Mark. This is a pretty clear call.
Yeah, any time we want to raise the nuts, we need to have a bluff in our range. And yeah, there's just none.
All right, great. So we do call, and Rianne folds, leaving us head.
Can I emphasize one thing? Sure. I think if we're, and Mark said this as well, but I want to underline, if we're deeper, this is a raise. Like, the main reason why we can call here is that we don't have to worry about building the pot, right? The pot is already very large relative to the stacks. If this is level one of a tournament and you're 200 big blinds deep, you need to be raising here to build
the pot. Raise, 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 raise.
Your opponent is so often going to have hands like sets and two pair where you need to get the money in now before a king or a queen falls and it kills your action.
Right. Full disclosure, I was actually at this table, and had I been Sursev with the nuts on the flop, I definitely would have called, because Rianne has been so wild and so just unpredictable. I would call and hope that he raises, and maybe we can end up playing a huge pot with him, because he just doesn't know what he's doing at all. So that's another reason to just call and see if you can get the cutoff to go crazy for you. So for all those reasons, Sursef does call. And unfortunately, Rianne folds, leaving us heads up with the original razor with the Jacksonville patch on. So the turn is the seven of clubs, which completes the flush. So we have a board of ace of diamonds, jack of clubs, ten of clubs, and seven of clubs. We now have 1.6 million in the pot. And our opponent bets 975.
Get it in.
Just shove, right?
I can't see any reason to do anything else.
Okay. If he has a flush, you know what? It's his day, not yours, right? Like, what flush does he even have?
Yeah, I mean, there's no folding this hand.
Right. That's exactly
and,
right.
And, like, I think calling here would be a mistake as well. Like, you get it in here, like, on the out, like, some weird chance, maybe he just has the king x of clubs or something, and he double barrels, like, you, I mean, just get it in.
Yeah, so, you know, what kind of range do we put this better on? I mean, this is a pretty sizable bet, right? I mean, it's more than half the pot on the scare card. Are we just not worried about his range because our hand is so strong, so we don't really care?
Yeah, it's just a question of how do you get it in against the bottom, or not even the bottom, but just like, I mean, it's, if he has a flush, he has a flush. Like, your stack-to-pot ratio is low enough that you're going to be stacking off to that. But I think he still has, like, sets, two pair. Like, he should still be betting and getting it in with those hands.
Right, right. He's not going to fold, so we're not worried about losing him when we shove.
Right.
And if he has a club, we actually don't really mind losing him that much. This pot is so big compared with our stack.
Yeah, I don't even know how many, like, king X of clubs, like, king 8 of clubs here or something, king 10 with the king of clubs, like, c-betting three-way, it's not very likely.
We're dead against those hands, but that's fine, yeah.
Oh, I'm saying just with, like, the king of clubs, just, like, one of them. But I don't think he could have, like, ace-king with the king of clubs. I mean, like, the point I guess I'm making is, and that Andrew said too, is that he's never folding here.
Yeah.
So just get it all now.
Yeah, and watching this hand unfold in person, I remember thinking that there was a good chance that the original bettor had a flush. I felt like I thought he could easily have an ace of clubs, king of clubs kind of hand for sure. And obviously those hands are in his range, but I mean, I definitely agree with you guys. If you flopped a joint on this board and then you just get, you know, outdrawn on the turn with this stack, I don't think you can really consider folding.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not really a question of, like, could he have a flush? It's a question of, like, how many other hands he could have.
Right. So, yeah, and I agree with two pair, the sets, and even possibly ace-king with no clubs might just keep betting because he's got a pair and a straight draw and whatever.
With what's out there and stuff, we beat way too many hands.
Yeah, agreed, 100%. So Sarasev, who we agree should shove, just calls the 975. And now the river is the 7 of spades, which pairs the board. And I only have 1.2 million left, and my opponent bets enough to put me all in. So there's 3.6 million in the pot. He bets 1.2, which is what I have remaining in my stack. Is the straight ever good? And are we still calling?
Yeah, I still think he's shoving ace jack and ace ten for value.
Mark?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's weird because I would never get to this spot, but
yeah, right.
You need to win like 20% of the time to call.
Yeah. So I think given the odds, he has to call. He folds. leaving himself with basically 12 big blinds, and the blinds were about to go up. He folded face up and showed us all that he had flopped a straight, and poor me, look at my luck. No one saw until the telecast that the original raiser actually had pocket tens, so results of the hand, he made a full house on the river. I think his bet on the turn is kind of interesting, that he bet so much. I guess he just figured the same as we did. My hand is too strong, and if my opponent has a flush, so be it. I have 10 outs against that hand anyway, so
yeah, I mean, he shouldn't be bet folding. His bet was less than, it was like 80% pot or something.
Yeah, it was 65% pot by my calculations. Reasonable correct. Bet. Yeah. So the raiser in this hand is Tony Miles, who ends up getting second in the main event. Well, I thought all these two hands were kind of interesting, kind of main event contrast. Like on one hand, you have Kelly, who, you know, made that really strong shove with the king high. I think she kind of figured out that her opponent had a lot of bluffs. I kind of agree with Andrew in that hand that maybe just calling the check raise and seeing what develops on the turn is also a way to handle it. But yeah, I just feel like we have like expert play on one hand, and then what's more common in the main event is the kind of, you know, pots like this. By the way, Rianne had a 6-3 offsuit and decided to just go ahead and see the flop. Yeah, so for those who say poker is dead, there's still plenty of action, in, especially in the main event. But I've been playing a lot of poker since the main event as well, and, you know, I see players doing some things that I don't understand and I think are really, really bad, and they probably are. So that's it. Yeah. So guys, I want to say, thank you so much for joining me. My first time kind of, steering the ship here. I couldn't have asked for two better guys to, start this journey with. So, Andrew, thank you very much. Why don't you tell people where they can find you on your hilarious Twitter?
At Thinking Poker on Twitter, and thinkingpoker.net is for the Thinking Poker podcast, and I will just emphasize this is thinking with a TH. I once had someone misunderstand and thought I was saying stinking poker, which would be an interesting parody. But
yeah, we should make that website too, just as another project. And Mark, let people know what you're up to and where they can find you as well.
AZN all in 007, Mark Alioto on Twitter, and then if anyone's going to Reno, the Peppermill series, October 21st 24th, Derek and I'll be out there killing bird. That's a really good series, actually. I'm pretty excited about the $200 six max shootout. It'll be fun to punt in. Smaller buy-ins and stuff, so we'll be out there hanging out, so come say what up.
The Peppermill is a real fun place to play. I've been there a few times.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it, actually. It's been a while since I've played live, so yeah, I'm pumped to get out there.
There's no place like Reno.
Mini Vegas.
I think we could all agree on that.
Yeah, that's literally true.
The cash games in Reno are really picking up now. I have a buddy that I follow on Twitter, and like they're getting some bigger games. I think it's only once a week, but they've been running like 25, 50 in some bigger games. I don't know if it's at Peppermill. I can't remember what casino, but yeah, cash games are back in Reno, so it should be fun.
Amazing. Well, that's cool. I wish you the best of luck out there, and Andrew as well, best of luck with all that you are doing and all the playing that you're doing in Maryland. There's a lot of good action in Maryland, too, with Maryland Live and, of course, the new place that I still haven't been to, the MGM property near Washington, D.C. You guys have been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you joining me. And for the listeners, let you guys know we are going to be doing this every week, maybe not this exact crew, but I'm going to be bringing you a podcast a week for the foreseeable future, which, as we know, does not exist. You guys can check me out on Twitter at Clayton Comic, same on Instagram at Clayton Comic, and be sure to send your feedback, rate and review the podcast, and all the other stuff that every podcast host in the world asks you to do on a regular basis. So for Andrew Brokus and Mark Alioto, I'm Clayton Fletcher. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week.
Texas, please fold them, let them hit me, raise it, baby, stay with me. Luck and intuition, play the cards with babes to start. And after she's been hooked, I'll play the one that's on her heart. Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. I'll get her heart, show her what I got. Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. I'll get her heart, show her what I got. Gambling is fun when you're with me.
I love it.
Russian roulette is not the same without a gun. And baby, when it's love, if it's not rough, it isn't fun, fun.
Oh, whoa, whoa, oh, whoa, whoa.
I'll get a heart, show her what I got.
Oh, whoa, whoa, oh, whoa, whoa.
I'll get a heart, show her what I got.
Everybody, no, she can't read my poker face. She's got to.